Hi folks, welcome to episode 32 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined as usual by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about Sir Charles Napier. Like Gordon of Khartoum, a man I don't really know much about, to be honest, so you're going to have to tell me what's the deal. Why is he notable?
Okay, well, he was a very successful military commander and sort of statesman in sort of the middle Victorian period.
That's what I like to hear. I need to read up on all of these. I really do.
To put it in some perspective, in the in Trafalgar Square, obviously, if people know, we've got a lot of American viewers, so they might not know, but there's Nelson's Column in the middle of Trafalgar Square.
And rightfully so.
And the Victorians loved him very, very much.
Yes.
And there's four plinths around Trafalgar Square. One is the fourth plinth, where they change what's on it all the time. The other three, one is George the Fourth, the Prince Regent. Mm-hmm. And the other two are extremely successful Victorian generals. One's Sir Henry Havelock, mm-hmm. and one is Sir Charles Napier, who we're going to talk about.
Okay.
One quick note on that. When it seems always to get mentioned, when Ken Livingstone, Red Ken, was the Mayor of London.
Yeah.
He said he had no idea who Sir Charles Napier or Sir Henry Havelock were.
I didn't really.
Yeah, no, but like, it's out there. You can read a book, Ken.
Yeah, but then I wasn't the Mayor of London.
Right.
So, but honestly, I really need to do some reading on the Victorian era. My knowledge of it is very sparse, to be honest.
I mean, you can be forgiven for not knowing. There's no reason.
Because I went through the public school system. I don't know anything.
I do fear that at some point those statues will come down, particularly Havelock and Napier.
Well, I've already seen articles published saying we need to take Nelson's Column down.
Say that all the time, yeah.
Yeah.
They would love that.
Yeah, and my response to that is, over my dead body, I will literally be out there protesting. Yeah, it's not happening.
Well, it would be quite difficult logistically to take that down, whereas statues of Napier and Havelock could be done in an afternoon.
And no one cares about them.
Not particularly. But so the reason why Sir Charles Napier, I think, is interesting, why I wanted to sort of do an epoch on him, if we're going to do this kind of thing, like Gordon of Khartoum, is that if you were born at just about the right time and had just about the right career, you could have been involved in loads and loads of really, really famous battles. And that is the story of Sir Charles Napier.
Right,
he's almost the same age as Richard Sharp in the Bernard Cornwell Sharp novels.
Oh, yeah.
Who's deliberately, obviously, he's been picked to be a certain window of time to fit everything you want to into it. And sort of Charles Napier's like the real deal.
Right,
he's like
The
actual, a legit example of that.
Okay,
so we can just jump straight into
it. Yeah, let's do it.
If you want. Okay, so he was actually aristocratic. His father was a colonel, but his mother was a lady. She was a very, very minor member of the royal family, like a great-great-granddaughter of Charles II or something like that. He was born in Westminster Palace or Kensington Palace, one of the London palaces. So he was very well-to-do, a bit more than well-to-do.
Well, he is, a member of the upper aristocracy.
Yeah, absolutely,
marrying royalty, you've got to be pretty important.
Yeah, right. And so when he's a young man, sort of 17 or so, he gets a commission, which again, you wouldn't get unless you're either very wealthy or connected. And his family was kind of both. So
just a quick aside on that. I love the fact that this is what our aristocracy used to do. Well, they're not just wasting time at home oppressing the peasants. No, they're oppressing people miles away overseas.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're for. You know, the only reason to keep them, why they have loads of kids and we could send them off to die in foreign wars. Brilliant. You know.
Well, they'd be the ones that stood to gain most from empire.
Exactly. So go on, get on with it.
It's funny, actually. Even today, if you watch documentaries about Iraq and Afghanistan, and nearly all the senior officers are extremely plummy, aren't they?
As they should be. That's
right, there's no problem with that.
Yeah, exactly.
It is the case even today.
You know, you want them to have the right education to be successful on the battlefield. Like, sorry, your average Tommy doesn't have the right education to command a battle. You know, it's just the fact of life, you know. And so you need a certain kind of person who's equipped to do that sort of thing. It's like, good, get them out there, get them doing stuff.
Yeah, and people that go to Sandhurst are usually extremely well-spoken or rich or connected or whatever. I mean, even the royal family, all the boys go into the services one way or the other.
Yeah, Harry and William have both served in, what is it, Afghanistan they both served in.
Yeah. I don't know if William actually served, but Harry definitely did. Harry was in an attack helicopter in Helmand.
Yeah, good.
I mean, kind of crazy in a way.
That's what I expect from the royal family, and that's what justifies their existence.
Moving on. Well, the disgraced soon to be completely disgraced Prince Andrew was a helicopter pilot in the Falklands. Actually, he flew combat missions, I believe. Was it the Royal Navy? Yeah, he was a helicopter pilot in the Royal Navy. Yeah, that's right. And even you see Prince Charles has got a uniform and everything. Yep. So, anyways. That's good. Yeah, that was all.
It's proper.
So he was part of a sort of, that sort of social elite, which was, and his father was in the military, you know, senior officer, a very senior officer. So it seemed like there was not really any doubt that he would go into the army.
See, I can completely see aristocracy justified as long as the aristocrats are out there risking their lives for queen and country.
Mm.
That I can see it's totally justified as long as they're getting shot at, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, whenever you watch a documentary about the Falklands or Afghanistan, Iraq, and they're interviewing some major, he will be extremely posh sounding almost every time. I can't think of many examples when that's not the case.
No, but I mean, my dad was in the RAF, and like he kept he was a sergeant for like 20 years, and he kept refusing a promotion to captain. And as a teenager, I was like, why? Why would you do that? But of course, my dad comes from a very, very working class background in Wiltshire. It's only in my later years that I realized that he was looking at it from a class angle, going, I'm not one of them. Right. I don't want to join them. You know, he would have felt massively out of place. Absolutely.
Maybe I heard a thing where when you're one of the more prestigious regiments, the Blues and Royals,
mm-hmm.
they're one of the household cavalry regiments.
Yeah.
And for your like passing out parade thing, you're passing out dinner, you have to wear a particular type of dinner jacket and things. And it costs tens of thousands of pounds to buy it. So it's like you're sort of not really wanted there unless you're rich. But that is an extreme job. I mean, the Blues and Royals are sort of as prestigious as it gets. I mean, I think Harry was in the Blues and Royals.
Right.
So, yeah. So anyway, just a quick overview on Sir Charles Napier's character before we sort of get stuck into the actions of it. He's one of those people, I've heard it described, where he's very difficult to pin down. He's like a contradiction of things.
Right.
Like he was obviously an imperialist, a Victorian imperialist, but also spoke against imperialism as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much, apparently very much for home rule in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
He disagreed with a lot of the things the East India Company were doing, even though he became sort of the most powerful man in the East India Company to some degree later. So it's like a contradiction of things. Mm. It's not easy to pin him down exactly.
Right. So I mean, I think that there is a fairly clean distinction between someone who does their duty, but also reserves the right to criticize those things that they see in excess, right?
Mm.
And like Rudyard Kipling seems like this as well. Like, you know, and Orwell just seems to be entirely against because of the things he saw. But like, I think it's fair for them to say, well, look, I know I have to do this thing, but, you know, there are real problems here, you know, and I'm not happy with this, this, and this. And I think that's good. I think that's noble.
Well, just to actually cut ahead to a point, make sense to leave right to the end, but I'll say it right now. He wrote a book at the very end of his life, which was called Defects, Civil and Military of the Indian Government.
Mm.
That was the name of the book.
Fantastic.
And it was published just after he died.
But that's constructive criticism, right?
Right.
And that's what it is. It's not like, oh, we need to, you know, we need a revolution to overthrow the state or anything like this. It's just, here's how you can improve. And that's good. That's useful. You know, that's decent.
So it's interesting that this guy is sort of, in some ways, many ways, sort of an arch imperialist, but also had massive reservations about it.
Yeah, he's not an insane zealot.
Right, yeah. I mean, and that's true of a lot of these guys.
Mm.
Just to think that they were all just blind imperialists, it's not the case. You know, reality is usually, often, in fact, much more nuanced. I hope they've co-opted that word.
But it sounds like he's approaching this with much more sort of clear eyes than someone like Cecil Rhodes.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that's fair to say. But I think maybe we'll get a bit more detail of that later when we get into it. So
his
early life, when he was a young man, so at one point he gets a commission or a commission is bought for him.
Yes.
He just buy
commissions.
And he didn't even take it up right away. He just spent another year in Ireland where some of his family were before he decided to take up his commission. Again, you could only do that. You could only get away with that if you're in a position of privilege.
Yeah.
Again, another word of co-opted. But
but I mean, that is like
it's actual privilege.
I think when we're talking about the British aristocracy, we can fairly use the term privilege.
Yeah.
And I think they would accept that too. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to retake that word back.
Yeah, that's a fair word to describe them.
Okay, so as a young man, he gets involved in the Peninsular War.
Right.
So the war against Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
The Peninsular War all takes place in Spain and Portugal, if people don't know.
Yep.
So he's a young man, and again, it's just like in the Sharp novels. He's just the right age to get involved in everything. And he was all over the place in the Peninsular War.
Right.
Kind of mad he wasn't killed, really, because he was at some of the most serious actions that were there. I mean, so first of all, he was a part of the 50th Regiment of Foot. And he was, well, so to begin with, the first big action he was involved with in Spain against Napoleon, or, well, not Napoleon personally, against his forces, commanded by Soult, or Saul, however you pronounce that, Marshal Soult. And the retreat, so a grand overview of the Peninsular War, very, very few words, is that France invaded Spain and Portugal. The British meant to help out the Spanish and the Portuguese, and the French pushed us all the way back to Lisbon, the tiny southwest corner of Lisbon, where there was sort of a last-ditch defence there, orchestrated by Wellington, which against the odds worked. And then over the next few years, pushed them further, further back, until eventually at the end of it all, we pushed them out of Spain entirely. And that's sort of towards the end of the Napoleonic era. There's a battle north of the Pyrenees at Toulouse, and then we go on and Paris falls and and the rest of it. So that's what happened in the Peninsular War.
It's we were allied with Portugal, so we kind of had an obligation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we've been, the British have been allies of the Portuguese for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Since
even before this.
Since like 1359?
Yeah.
England and Portugal have been allied just out of convenience, really, for literally hundreds of years, over half a millennium, like 700 years. Crazy.
I've heard it said it's one of the longest formal alliances
in the world. It is the longest alliance, yeah.
Crazy,
the
right?
Yeah, and I mean, and the thing is, like, Britain inherited the alliance when the United Kingdom was incorporated. Like, it was, you know, Portugal's like, right, it was happening. Well, it's been a long time. We've changed a bit. You know, we're still buddies, though, carry on.
So in order to sort of thwart Napoleon, you know, you his enemies become your closest friends, you know. And so anyway, we're pushed, the story is we're pushed all the way back to Lisbon, and then eventually we push them all the way back. So it's a real reversal of fortunes. And that's largely done under Arthur Wellesley, becomes the Duke of Wellington. But to begin with, it was under the commander John Moore. And in this sort of retreat, the first sort of phase of the retreat, the main British army under John Moore were pushed back to Coruña, which is right in the northwest of Spain, right in the very northwest corner of Spain. And Napier was there again as a young man. We're sort of talking 1809. He wasn't that young, he's sort of late 20s, 30 odd. But most of the sort of fantastic things that happen in Napier's life when he's older, when he's sort of late 50s, 60s. So he was at Coruña, where again, we really, by rights, Soult should have swept us into the sea and killed all of us. But there was a great defence. Moore himself was killed, struck by a cannonball just outside Coruña and killed. That's why they had to change the sort of senior leadership, and why people like Wellington, Arthur Wellesley, ended up sort of getting that sort of top job. So he was at Coruña, which is sort of incredible. It's thought of as the lowest ebb for the British in that entire war. But then the next year he was in Portugal. He was at the Battle of Cal, probably pronouncing that wrong, and Busaco. Again, we're now under the command of Wellington by this point. A couple of battles where sort of strategic retreats, but still do really well. Again, he was there, sort of very, very lucky not to get killed. In fact, I missed a small detail there. At Coruña, he was wounded, badly wounded, left for dead wounded.
Oh, bloody.
Yeah, and captured by the French.
Right, okay, yeah.
And because he was a sort of a middling officer, already he wasn't a junior officer, sort of a middling officer, and well-known, sort of a member of the aristocracy, Soult, well, actually, I think he was passed over to Ney, Marshal Ney, my personal favourite of the Napoleonic.
The cavalry
commander. Marshal. Yeah. He's not the best in terms of military prowess, but he's just my favourite. His character is very interesting. Ney said, I tell you what, you can go home for 3 months to convalesce and get better in England, but you've got to come back to my custody.
Yeah.
And he said yes, and they did.
Well, this is not the first time this has happened.
We talked about that in the Hundred Years' War. Yeah, that it was crazy to do then, and it was happening in the 19th century.
That's good. I think that's excellent.
Yeah.
You know, you made a deal, you got to honour it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's so... Yeah, it's so
the French
sort of,
King John did, so you've got to.
It's noble of spirit, isn't it, to it sort is. Of keep to that.
I think it is.
That your word is actually valuable.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, sad world we live in where that is just, it's almost laughable that someone would keep to their word.
Well, it's crazy. We couldn't imagine it now, but, you know.
And in the end, he is exchanged and gets back to British lines legitimately. Mm. And so he goes on, although he was really quite badly wounded, he didn't end his career. Mm-hmm. And so in 1810, he was at a couple of big battles. Again, in 1811, he was at the Battle of Fuentes de Orano on the Orano River. Again, sort of one of the big set-piece engagements. Mm-hmm. And he won a silver clasp for that, which they don't just hand out for nothing.
Right, okay. So I don't even know what a silver clasp is.
Well, it's just for, it's a, for a type of gallantry, really.
Yeah.
So again, it's... In the early, very, well, it's not even the Victorian period, is it? It's the Regency period. You don't get given medals for nothing.
No.
You've got to really earn it. Yeah. Like, genuinely earn it. Do something crazy, really.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.